Everyone, thank you for tuning into the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. You're listening to episode 11 of Postmodern Realities, and I'm Melanie Cogdill, managing editor of the Christian Research Journal. On this episode, I'm joined by Paul A. Nelson. Paul is currently a fellow of the Discovery Institute and an adjunct professor in the Master of Arts program in Science and Religion at Biola University. Paul has a BA in philosophy with a minor in evolutionary biology from the University of Pittsburgh. He also has a PhD in the philosophy of biology and evolutionary theory from the University of Chicago. In the volume 39, number 3 issue of the Christian Research Journal, Paul has written an article about the genetic fallacy argument for our effective evangelism column. Effective evangelism is a practical advice column on how to reach people of other faiths and of no faith with the gospel. Authors share general tips on how to reach these people, explore a particular evangelistic tactic that has proven effective, or focus on how to overcome a particular challenge that often comes up. In his article called Why Accept the Pythagorean Theorem, Paul deals with the genetic fallacy argument made by new atheists. Paul, it's good to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, explain the title of your article, because genetic fallacy is not in it.
Well, I'll tell you, it's an interesting kind of puzzle that arises when people say how you learn something matters to its truth. Okay, so I'll give you a very simple example. Suppose I've got two people, and one of them has a PhD in astrophysics, right, from an Ivy League institution, and he knows a lot about stellar composition, what the sun is made of. The other guy is a truck driver, but he loves to read, and he loves to read science books. And we ask both of them, how does the sun operate? What are the nuclear reactions going on in the sun? And they give us answers independently that are remarkably consistent. So the PhD gives us one answer, and the truck driver gives us another answer. And we ask the audience, which one of these guys is right? And the people say, well, obviously the PhD. And we say, why? And they say, well, because he has a PhD. And we say, but the truck driver gave the same answer. And they say, but we can't really trust him. He's a truck driver. That is an example of the genetic fallacy, because it doesn't matter to the truth of a proposition how you learn it or when you learn it. We judge the truth of propositions, which is what we're talking about here, on the basis of, do they correspond to reality? And I would say, you know what, the truck driver, in fact, gave the same answer as the PhD, and so he's asserting what we know about how the sun operates, and the fact that he learned it on his own by going to a public library and working really hard and studying is strictly irrelevant to what he says. So anytime you say to somebody, well, I need to know how or when you learned that before I can evaluate its truth, that's a fallacy, because that's not, in fact, how we establish truth.
But doesn't it matter how or when we learn something? In other words, if you gave that example with the PhD, it seems to me more weight would be given because this person has spent more time, perhaps, or just because of the prestigiousness of where they got their PhD?
You know, That sort of is our intuition. But remember, why do we do that? Why do we give more weight? Well, we give more weight because we think it's probably more likely that working hard and studying a topic in an academic setting, you're likely to pick up more propositions that, in fact, do correspond to reality. But that is the benchmark. We always have to go back to, what do we regard as true? And why? And, you know, the standard that we use is not actually how you learn something. That's simply an indicator of, well, we think it's more likely that you're going to pick up things that are true and accurate if you study them in a university. But let's flip the situation around. Suppose you are taught a theory in that university that actually is false, in that case, we would say it doesn't matter that you went to the university. So, for instance, someone learning Marxist theory of the economy or Marxist theory of labor in a Soviet institution, we'd say, look, it really doesn't matter that you went to a Soviet institution and studied hard, or to a Soviet university and study hard. The theory that you learn doesn't correspond to reality. So we always have to go back in our thinking to where do we judge truth, and whatever else we use has to be downstream of that, such as where did you happen to be educated.
In your article, you mentioned Richard Dawkins, who is the well-known atheist, and he's also an evolutionary biologist and the best-selling author of a few books, including The God Delusion. So what do you think of his arguments in his book, The God Delusion?
Well, I have to say they're not very good. I have a lot of respect for Dawkins as a writer. In fact, when I taught writing at the University of Chicago, I taught in their professional writing program for a few years. I would use passages out of his book, The Blind Watchmaker, because they were so beautifully written. So he's wonderful at explaining things. He's a master of English prose, and I think he is very honest insofar as he tells people what he actually thinks. In fact, that's got him into trouble in the past. But I want to separate those attractive features of Richard Dawkins from what he argues, the content of what he argues in The God Delusion, and the arguments in that book that I personally have evaluated, including the one that I write about in my new article for the Christian Research Journal, those arguments really aren't very good. And I think Richard Dawkins often resorts to what amount, in the end, to cheap shots. Or to express the point more formally, what amount to fallacies. So in the article in the Christian Research Journal, I analyze one of Dawkins' arguments, and I say, this is an instance of the genetic fallacy. You really shouldn't put any weight on this as a reader. Now, I think some other of his arguments have more substance. For instance, I think the problem of evil, which is a problem dealt with in the Bible, in the book of Job, in Romans, really throughout the whole of Scripture, the writers are grappling with the problem of evil. I think that is something that is a legitimate topic for discussion, and Christians need to take it very seriously. I think the Bible gives us answers to the problem of evil. But and Dawkins talks about it in The God Delusion, but really the bulk of what he argues there, I think it really doesn't deserve to be called good philosophy.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is Paul Nelson, who has written an article about the genetic fallacy for our Effective Evangelism column, and it's called Why Accept the Pythagorean Theorem. And it is in the Volume 39, Number 3 issue of the Christian Research Journal. His article is in a very special issue of the journal, which is only available as a thank you gift for your donation to the ongoing work of the Christian Research Institute. To donate and receive Volume 39, Number 3, please go to equip.org. We were just talking about Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, and in there, does he argue against theism based on someone's personal history?
Yes, he does. In fact, there's a whole chapter that he dedicates to that question. I'll paraphrase what he says. He says, if you're struggling with your religious faith and you realize that this was something that was taught to you in childhood and you never really had a chance to disagree with it, he said, the real problem is you've been indoctrinated in a worldview that you have no reason to believe, and because you were taught this, now there's the key claim, because you were taught this as a child, you should doubt it and find a way to throw off the yoke of this religious faith that he says is strictly unreal. Now, the problem with that claim is we're taught, you know, lots of things as children. The fact that we teach children, the Ten Commandments, let's say, thou shalt not kill, honor thy father and mother, and so forth, that is not strictly relevant, really, in any sense, to whether those commandments are valid. You know, I think Dawkins looks at world religions, including Christianity, and he says the only reason, or the main reason, that these religions survive is because they're drummed into kids before kids have a chance to disagree. Well, one of the things I mentioned in the article, and if you want the full details, you need to go and read it, is look at Dawkins' own personal history. He was educated in private Anglican schools. They're called public schools in the UK. That adjective means something very different than our sense of public school. Anyway, he was educated in private Anglican schools, and until his mid-teens regarded himself as a theist. He's not one today. So how is it possible that he was able to shake off his childhood indoctrination? Maybe it's not true that what you're taught as a child will stick with you as an adult. And I think the ongoing debates about the rise of new atheism in our country illustrate that. Most of the so-called prominent new atheists that I know had some significant religious instruction as children. If Dawkins were right, that should stick with them, and yet they seem to be able to shake it off. So I think this is another example of a really wretchedly bad argument being put forward by Richard Dawkins. And someone, either Dawkins himself or his editor or friends who read the manuscript, should have said to him, hey, maybe you need to rethink this.
You mentioned the new atheists, and I'm thinking also, in addition to Dawkins, there's Christopher Hitchens and Sam Harris, all of whom are best-selling authors. How should Christians respond to them?
Well, I think the first thing to realize is really none of this is new. So how the adjective new ever came to be attached to the new atheists is a bit of a mystery to me. But you can go back really hundreds of years before the birth of Christ in Greek philosophy. So we're not even talking about the role of the Bible here. We're just talking about smart people trying to understand the world in terms of what they knew at the time. You can find arguments pro-atheism and pro-theism. Not talking about the God of the Bible now, but the Greek concept of God. Hundreds of years before the birth of Christ, the very same arguments are taking place. So really, this is nothing new. And what happens is the content of the arguments may shift in terms of what science knows or what we know about history. But at their core, these arguments are identical to the ones made by ancient Greek philosophers. So that, I think, will help, first of all, people kind of relax and say, you know what, these arguments have been around for a long time. I need to understand them. I need to evaluate them. But really, there's nothing new here. I think what is new is you've got a greater willingness to be outspoken about it. People don't have quite the proper manners they used to when I was a college student, even. The atheists today are a lot more outspoken about their atheism. And in one sense, I think that's healthy, because it helps Christians to realize that we live in a world where Christianity is viewed with great hostility, and we need to have the tools, spiritual and intellectual, to respond to the arguments that we hear. But remember, these arguments have been around for a long time, and Christianity has survived them.
So why do you think this new atheism has drawn so much attention, particularly in pop culture? In other words, some of these books have become bestsellers, and it's not normally the kind of book in the past that would become a bestseller.
Well, I think you've got some very talented people. Richard Dawkins is a really good writer. He's funny. He's witty. He knows how to turn a phrase. Sam Harris is another good writer. I think Christopher Hitchens, his humor and bluntness are attractive. I mean, think about it this way. You're sitting in a middle school classroom, and there's a kid in the back that everyone knows is really funny, and he's quick, and he's kind of a rebel. So on any given day in that middle school classroom, you never quite know what that guy's going to say, and you're sort of paying attention, like, you know, is he going to sass the teacher today? Is he going to have some smart remark that gets him sent to the principal and so forth? That sort of personality draws attention. And I think one of the things that did happen with new atheism is you got a group of people who were very clever, very funny, and outspoken and not afraid to offend. And I think in that context, and also I think with the intellectual weakness of much of American evangelical Christianity, where the emotions are upheld but the brain is not, and the mind ends up getting the short end of the stick, you've got a kind of perfect storm for something like New Atheism to attract a lot of attention.
In your article, you mention meme theory, and I want you to explain that to us, because I think most of us, when we think about that, we think of a photo that someone texts you or is on the internet of some funny picture with a saying on top of it. So what exactly are the origins of that?
Well, the word meme itself was coined by Richard Dawkins, I believe in the mid-70s, explicitly to parallel the term gene. So a gene is a piece of information carried in someone's DNA that has a particular function. And Dawkins argues that in biology, genes are primary, that genes kind of run the show, that we are, in a sense, robots driven by our DNA. Well, he was looking for a similar term to describe ideas. Ideas, though, that had the peculiar property of being autonomous. In other words, let's say you hear a commercial jingle, and there are commercial jingles on television stations here in Chicago that drive me absolutely crazy, because when I hear them, just a little five-second musical ditty, I can't get them out of my head. It takes a conscious effort to get that annoying little jingle out of my mind. Now, Dawkins would say the reason you have a hard time, Paul, getting it out of your head is it's a meme. It's this little bit of information that has autonomy in the sense that once it lands in your brain, you find yourself whistling it, even though you really can't stand it, or humming it, and somebody else hears it, and the same thing happens. It kind of parasitizes their brain. They can't get rid of it, and it just spreads through the population. So the basic notion is memes are these visual or auditory entities that pass from brain to brain, and in a sense, they're active. They're like viruses, mind viruses. So if you take that picture of how we know or how ideas are communicated seriously, you'll take a position like Dawkins. You'll say, you know what, we need to protect kids from the meme that they have a soul. We need to protect kids from the meme that their soul will endure eternally. Because once that meme grabs hold of their brain, they won't be able to get rid of it, and they're going to infect other people with it. So mimetic theory actually has been fairly well developed. It has lots of problems, but one of the things that's attractive about the idea to materialists is it lets them explain, they think, phenomena like religion, where they say, well, why is religion so popular? Why do so many people go to church on Sunday? Why do so many people pray or regard themselves as having an eternal soul? Because they say, not that any of that is true, but their minds were infected by these religion memes, and we need to get rid of those memes. We need to inoculate people against them, in a sense. So there's a thumbnail sketch of meme theory, and I think that there are critical, or more or less fatal, flaws with the idea. Because, in fact, I don't think that's how we know. Yes, I hear a jingle, but the jingle is not something that's parasitizing my brain. The explanation for why that little musical ditty is stuck in my mind has an explanation very different from there being this entity that's parasitized my mind.
So what would you say to the person that would believe that belief in God is a meme? I mean, if we're talking to some friend who claims that they're a new atheist, and they would say, well, you only believe this because that's the culture you were, you know, raised in, and therefore your belief in God is a meme. It's just something you can't get out of your mind because you were influenced by it.
Well, the problem is, if you take that seriously, it applies to absolutely everything you know, including, in the case of the materialist or the atheist, all the science that they're leaning on. And you can just turn it around on them and say, look, the only reason you believe in Darwinian evolution is because that particular Darwin meme got your brain, right? And in fact, your whole belief in mimetic theory itself is a meme. And once you do that, once you turn your rationality over to some autonomous entity, it is powerfully destructive of everything that you know, including basic logic. So the notion of rationality itself requires, I think, at its base, that there be some level of understanding that we have that is not strictly dependent on things like memes. So, first of all, there is a sort of self-referential incoherence about the notion of memes that if you take the idea seriously, it ends up destroying itself or got like a tail, like a snake swallowing its own tail, sort of. There's a second problem, though. Most of the people who say religion is a meme apparently are not affected by that meme. So why is it that they are able to escape the effect of this parasite when the people down the block or their next-door neighbor or their kids have been affected by the meme, and it ends up being a very ad hoc explanation? Because you say, well, you've got the meme, but I didn't. And I say to my skeptic or atheist friend, you just sat and laughed at Joel Osteen for 45 minutes. You sat there watching a YouTube video about some television evangelist that you can't stand, and you heard him preaching for 20 minutes, and you just sat there and listened. Why didn't all those memes grab your brain? And they say, well, I'm above all that. And with one mighty leap, Jack is free, right? So the problem with memetic theory is it approaches the question of truth from exactly the wrong perspective. Really, it's kind of a very, very souped-up version of the genetic fallacy.
Well, I know that people who hold to a naturalistic worldview would say that people who are religious, like us, would be people who have irrational beliefs. So would you say that their worldview would ever sacrifice rationality?
I do think that naturalism or materialism comes at a very high cost. And that's because in a related vein to the answer I just gave, if you say that your understanding of truth, that your understanding of rationality itself, that your understanding of basic things like mathematics or logic is a consequence of an undirected material process, the first question you should ask yourself is, why should I believe as true anything that I have learned? If there's no me at home, if there's no rational intellect that in some important sense is independent of physical reality, assessing the truth of propositions, assessing the truth of a claim of science against the evidence and so forth. If it's all driven by particles in motion, then even my belief that there are particles or that there is such a thing as truth or falsehood, that is imperiled by materialism. Dan Dennett talks about Darwinism as being the universal acid that eats away everything. And I think materialism or naturalism, two names for this, really the same kind of worldview, ends up being an acid that destroys that worldview itself. Darwin famously said, why should I trust my own thoughts any more than, and this is a paraphrase, why should I trust my own thoughts any more than the thoughts of a baboon? So Darwin himself was able to see that a materialist understanding of rationality runs the real risk of being self-referentially incoherent, because it is an acid, to borrow Dan Dennett's term, it's an acid that you can't control. How do you stop that? How do you stop that acid? Well, one way of stopping it is to say, there is something in my self-awareness, in my consciousness, in my ability to grasp something like the truth of mathematics that transcends the material. And now this makes perfect sense, but it's not materialistic. So a Platonist in mathematics, let's say, who says that numbers, while they are not material, are perfectly real, that they exist in a realm that's not material but is nevertheless perfectly real, he can go on and do beautiful mathematics. In fact, many of the greatest mathematicians of history have been Platonists in that sense. But he'll have a hard time being a materialist. So I'm perfectly willing to sacrifice materialism. I think, you know, there's material out there. Mass energy are real, but they're not the whole of reality. So I guess bottom line is I think materialism and naturalism have a superficial plausibility. They look attractive, but they end up being powerfully destructive of things we want to hang on to, like logic, like mathematics, like science, like rationality itself.
Well, finally, I want to end with some fun rapid-fire questions for Paul. So, Paul, spaghetti and meatballs or lasagna?
Oh, lasagna.
How many languages do you speak?
Well, one, and I can read German. I can speak it very, very slowly. I passed my graduate language exam in German, and I was waiting in a San Diego airport line a couple of days ago, and there was a couple in front of me speaking German, and I think I could understand about every other sentence.
What is your most favorite thing about your job?
Getting to do fun things like this, talking to people and explaining things.
And do you collect anything?
Books, and I have way too many of them. My study is overflowing, and my wife is threatening to come in and do a purge herself.
Well, right now it's May 2016, so what is the most exciting thing that has happened to you this month?
I saw a blue whale in Southern California off of Dana Point, and I can now die happy. It's a bucket list item, knowing that I've seen the largest species God ever made. I mean, it took my breath away. In fact, my wife on her Facebook page posted a little video clip of this blue whale. That's like three city buses long. You know, this is an enormous, enormous animal. I never thought I would have the privilege of seeing a blue whale, and I did. That was exciting.
That does sound exciting. Thanks, Paul, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Paul Nilsson has written an article about the genetic fallacy argument for our effective evangelism column called Why Accept the Pythagorean Theorem for the Volume 39, Number 3 issue of the Christian Research Journal. His article is in a very special issue of the journal that is only available as a thank you gift for a donation to the ongoing work of the Christian Research Institute. To donate and receive Volume 39, Number 3, please go to equip.org. Be sure you tune in daily to the Bible Answer Man broadcast hosted by CRI President Hank Canegraff, who answers your questions live on air. To ask Hank a question, call 888-ASK-HANK, Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Make sure you go to equip.org, where you can download our free smartphone app, on which you can listen to the Bible Answer Man broadcast live, listen to previous broadcasts, make a donation, and subscribe to the Christian Research Journal.